Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Chris Abani, author of the novel Graceland, poet, also author of two earlier novels, Masters of the Board and Sirocco. Chris Abani, Graceland, the main character of Graceland, Elvis Oakey?
Yes, Elvis Oakey.
Elvis Oakey is 16 in 1983, which is when the book takes place. That's about your age, right?
Yes.
Is there a lot of Chris Abani in Elvis Oakey?
It's always a difficult thing, autobiography and novel.
Sure.
But it would be, I wouldn't lie and say there isn't. There are parts of me, but then there are parts of also friends of mine who are the same age. So it's all characters are pastiches of people we know. So it's, yeah, there are bits of me in there.
Elvis is born in a town of Afikpa.
Afikpa.
And winds up in Lagos in Morocco, which is a slum.
Yes.
Are these places that you were familiar with when you were growing up in Nigeria?
I was actually born in Afikpa and raised there. So I'm very familiar with all the sort of manhood rituals and stuff that are performed there. Lagos I didn't get to go to until I was 16, and then, of course, spent prison time there. But I am familiar with Morocco. My uncle actually had a church in Morocco.
The entire story of Graceland. First of all, let's talk about the Elvis part of it, Graceland.
Sure.
Elvis.
Okay.
What prompted you? Because outside of being a little bit of the American dream, there's a resonance there that I want you to go into. What do you see the title and the title character being?
It's a coming-of-age story in a particular time in Nigeria, which is sort of a country that is inundated with American mythology via things like the Elvis and the movies and things like that. But particularly, it becomes a sort of double play irony on the whole idea of Graceland. People have said, is this really Raceland? And this kind of, but no, it really is this mythical place that one creates in a sense to transition in a sort of redemption from darkness to light or growing into manhood in a certain way. The other resonances, of course, are the whole idea of, well, the whole book is sort of set around the notion of dancing, as one dances through culture, literally. And here's Elvis Presley here in the United States, copying, say, the more fluid African-American dancers, reproducing a sort of stiffer thing, which this kid in Nigeria tries to copy again. So it's sort of how, inevitably, things borrowed, change, and so the culture is this fluid intermixing of things, yeah.
When Elvis travels through his various adventures to reach a point where
right.
he literally becomes redemption, the character
right.
redemption,
right.
as the book continued, it appeared that magic realism began to play more and more mm-hmm. of a role, and I kept seeing the influence of Garcia Marquez.
Mm.
Is that deliberate?
It's deliberate as well. The magic realism thing is a very peculiar thing because there was a Nigerian writer called Emos Tutuola who, I think about 1956, began to write these incredible books like The Palm Wine Drinker and so forth, which work in that sort of way with language and conflations of time. So there is a little bit of that, but I mean, no one in Nigeria with any kind of literary background has grown up without reading at least, 100 Years of Solitude. And the things that magic realism allows you to do in terms of transmutation was really important for me in this book. So it's a way for the old culture and the new culture to sort of experience themselves simultaneously.
When Elvis travels through his various adventures to reach a point where
right.
he literally becomes redemption, the character
right.
redemption,
right.
on that road, there are several key incidents, and I wonder how many of those are based on actual fact.
It's always a difficult thing because a novel, it shouldn't really be based on fact. But unfortunately, a lot of it is. There are torture scenes in the book which are based on my time as a political prisoner. Some of the relationship between the character and his father, myself and my father trying to work out, we were on opposing sides of the political debate, as it were. So there's a lot of that. The human organs trade is an unfortunate fact that is going on right now as we speak. So there is a lot of it that's based on fact. I suppose the role of art then is to pull everyday life into a fabric that provides a moment of transformation in a way.
Well, let's go into some of that and relate it back to both Chris Abani and your book. Now, Elvis grows up in Afikpa,
mm-hmm.
as you did. His father is an opposition politician and
right.
educator,
right.
which means Chris grows up well-educated.
Very much so.
I mean, Elvis grows up educated.
That's Elvis similar. Grows up, and I grew up very educated too, yes. I come from a very middle-class family. My father had a very high-ranking job in the government, and he was at one point an educator himself.
Even though he was very educated, there were all kinds of witch doctors hanging out. Was that similar? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a bit like East Los Angeles, you know. there are signs for tarot card readers all over the place, and it's a mix of the brujo and the church. So it's very much so. And it's not witch doctors sort of in the stereotypical sense of it. It's more like where native religious beliefs, like what informs Santeria and other things, conflates with Christianity to produce an almost schizophrenic beingness. So there are lots of stuff like that. But, you know, it's a schizophrenic culture, part Western, part something that was arrested 400 years ago that is still trying to find its own sort of expression. So there are these mixtures of things going on.
When you came to the United States and you learned about things like Santeria, there are differences between what you grew up with.
Right.
That must have been a very odd feeling for you to see this kind of mutated form of your own culture.
This is the thing that's wonderful about a country like Nigeria, is that it's not isolated in that sort of sense. And there are Santeria practitioners there. And so part of what the book is sort of looking at is how culture, things are exported from say, Nigeria to the diaspora. They're reshaped and then they're imported back. And then they're further deconstructed. So in Nigeria, I mean, I was in the Hare Krishna ashram for a few weeks before I got kicked out. I get kicked out of things a lot. And so there are all these things going on. So it wasn't so strange in that sense for me, because Santeria is very similar to sort of the spiritual churches we have back home. So what really fascinates me is that certain places allow for this cultural blurring to occur. And I think that it's in those moments of sort of the cracks in the pavement that new things begin to emerge. America is a similar sort of place in many ways.
Elvis, okay, very bright kid, mm-hmm. very literate kid. Mm-hmm. And when he's still living in Afikpa, mm-hmm. which is up to the age of 13.
Right.
When he's living there, it's obvious that he's living a very different life yeah. than he led later. Let's compare that to Chris Abani. Now, you said you went to Lagos 3 years later than he did.
Right.
But still, when you were there, your life stayed middle class?
Pretty much. When I went the first time to Lagos, really, I think I was 16. My book had just been published, and I went for the book launch, which was, you know, a pretty big event. And then I visited various times to do appearances and things, but then I went back at 18 as a prisoner of the government. And that was a different experience. Then having extended family, like I had my father's youngest brother owned a church similar to a Santeria church in Morocco, the slum that we talked about. And so it was at that point that that side of my family that I'd never met, I came into contact with and began to actually see how the large percentage of Nigeria's population, I would say about 70%, really lives, which is different from the 30% that I belong to.
Did you know growing up how different and how privileged you actually were?
No, because I grew up in a very rural community with people who had a very strong sense of self based on a traditional system of belief. And in that place, I suppose looking back now, I realize how privileged I was. But no one cut you any slack. You had to fit in. You had to learn languages and be part of the culture in that way. And that's how you earned any respect. And it was a more sort of, you know, laid-back life. It's even, say, the difference between Los Angeles and Fresno, I'd say. But so there are those differences. But what's also intriguing, though, is that within this small town, it wasn't an idyllic situation. There's a lot of internal family tyranny that goes on. And the state tyranny reflects in the families, and it spreads throughout. I think the real difference between those two communities, Lagos and the village, I suppose in America it'd be a town. It's 250,000 people. We call a village because we have a lot of people in a small area.
So we're talking a pretty large city.
Yeah,
actually.
Well, it would be here, but it's like living in London. In England, there's London, and then there's everything
right.
else isn't London, and so Lagos and everything else isn't Lagos, and so anything that isn't Lagos is sort of thought of as a village. But the thing about Lagos is that the concentration of crime, the ways in which poverty really grinds you down in the face of richness. In a rural community, it's more hidden. But in a big city, the divide is larger, and so provided an opportunity for greater contrast.
Elvis wants to be a dancer. Chris Abani, I guess, always wanted to be a writer.
Yes.
How old were you when you started writing?
Very young. I published my first piece in a newspaper when I was 10. I had entered a competition for 18-year-olds and sort of won a second prize. And when I turned up for the prize, I'm not a very slim man now, but then I was shorter, so I was like this little round basketball that rolled down the aisle to sort of take this prize among all these older teenagers. And just the shock on people's faces sort of brought home to me the impact that words could really have. And that, I think, was a turning point. And I began to write more seriously after that.
And were you supported by your father?
I was supported by my mother. My father didn't care much for that. In Nigeria, the culture is very much one where there's a time and a place for everything. And you didn't write until you'd finished being educated. So you would have to be in your late 20s, early 30s. And the idea of this sort of precocious child wanting to write was one problem. The other difficulty as well is if you live in a country where masculinity is constructed in exaggerated ways, this movement towards a more sensitive, what could be perceived as a more sensitive side, troubles the field of masculinity. And fathers want, there's a scene in the book where that happens, where the kid does a little bit of makeup and stuff when he's about 9, and the father, you know, literally knocks his head off and then shaves his hair to, you know, because the idea is that you, as a man, you can only be a certain way in this culture. So it was difficult between my father and I.
Did you go through the kind of ritual that Elvis goes through?
Yes, I did. The shooting of the imagined eagle, which was...
Right.
And the killing of goats and chickens, yes, I did.
I guess your feelings were similar to those of Elvis, which has kept
right.
me out of here.
Yes, pretty much the same. Pretty much the same.
Elvis's mother, Beatrice, dies of cancer. Does that parallel your life, or is your mother still alive? Or?
My mother's still very much alive and very cancer-free.
Why did you make that choice?
If you cut an individual free of all the supportive aspects of their life, it enables you to position them on the edge of tension when they make these choices later off in life more sort of ritualized, but also because I was raised by women to be a woman in many ways, to cook and clean and do this stuff, but all my art comes from women, but was honed in opposition to masculinity. And that's what happens with Elvis in this case. He's cut free of the nurturing source, the mother, the grandmother, and sort of juxtaposed against a father who basically is very eatable. You know, he has to cut his teeth against that whole thing, yeah.
Chris Abani, in the book, Elvis and his father Sunday go to the slums of Lagos because there's been government change and he's had to flee. Was government change, that sort of government change, did that kind of thing happen in the same way as you describe for other families? Obviously not for yours.
Yes. I mean, it wasn't... I mean, what made Elvis's father, Sunday, move to this slum city was because he'd actually spent all his money in a campaign and lost out in the election and had to sort of go down in the world, in other words. But coups, military coups happened every 2 to 5 years, and we would sort of all cheer the new person in, knowing fully well what was going to happen in a couple of months. But, you know, any change was better than any kind of the staticness of one dictator.
It was kind of like meet the new boss, same as the old.
Yes, it's pretty much like that. And so it was, it's in many ways, there are a lot of parallels between recent American events and what was going on then.
Well, the ultimate aim is cynicism, both
right.
from, it's the outcome, but it's also the aim right. of the people doing it. Because if you're right. cynical and you don't care,
right.
you don't take any action.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, as well, though, that there's through the book, there's a lot of resistance to authority and to power that comes, and this is really the truth about Nigeria, it comes from people with no access to power. And so they often, history erases their effort in a way. And this is a whole generation. I mean, literally my generation from 1983 upwards, I would say most intellectuals in Nigeria were in some way or the other engaged in anti-government or anti-dictatorship activities through art, through formal protests and so forth. And so but what happens is that certain individuals, through accidents of history or through being able to write or articulate their events in certain ways, seem to stand out a bit more. But it's more of a generational experience, you know.
Your first novel was published when you were 18 years old, Masters
yeah.
of the Board. It,
yeah.
it sounds to me as if it was some kind of World War II thriller. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it actually was published when I was 16 and got relaunched at 18 after the the coup thing. But it was basically a very bizarre crime thriller that involved neo-Nazis taking over Nigeria as a first step towards reinstituting the Fourth Reich. It had no basis in reality. The only way it posed any danger, as it later spun out, was that one of the generals, who was a very strong supporter of the arts and a strong supporter of myself, was accused of planning a coup to overthrow the incumbent government. The idea was that his coup was a blueprint for my novel. All the strategic targets that were blown up in my book became the targets he had laid out for his coup. That's my first sort of accidental encounter with history in many ways.
You're listening to an interview with Chris Abani, whose novel is Graceland. That novel, when you wrote it, when it was published, you obviously wouldn't have had no fears that the government would use it in some way to have you arrested.
Not only did I have no fears, I was not even actually very conscious of any anti-government activities. Bearing in mind, my father was a highly placed person in government, and so I was sort of raised with blinkers in many ways. It was completely the last thing from my mind.
Was that first arrest similar to Elvis's arrest?
Well, the arrest was sort of similar, but what happens to Elvis in the book comes from later arrests. But my first arrest was traumatic enough, but the extent of the torture was just beatings and things like that, which in a culture where you get beaten a lot anyway, it's not that. It was relative to what was to come later. It was comparatively easy. What happens when you're thrust, though, in that kind of situation, your political education is accelerated and you become really aware of what's going on. And being a young man, it's a mix of idealism and the savior complex. So there's a bit of ego and a bit of, you know, of other things going on.
Elvis is released in a very strange way. Somebody says, hey, let him go, out of the blue, when he's pretty much assumed he's dead meat. Was that similar?
That was pretty much similar to what happened on the second arrest. It was almost like, well, even with the first one, it's almost like they held this 18-year-old. They thought, there's no way he was involved in this coup. Oh, I don't know what to do with him. Oh, I'll just let him go. And that's pretty much what happened.
Several other elements of the book. First of all, the character names. Redemption, Innocent, Comfort.
The actual Nigerian names. In Nigerian culture, your name is sort of a talisman that performs your life role, as it were. So I grew up with people called Endurance and Confidence, and people whose parents had been forced laborers under the British named their kids Sixpence, which was the base pay they got. So I'm assuming it meant after this, it can only get better for you. What I did was to take all of that and introduce a further level of irony in the book, because Comfort, the stepmother, is anything but comforting. And Sunday is anything but religious. And Innocent is a murderer and all this sort of stuff. So it was a little play on those ideas.
And the colonel.
There have been several the colonels in Nigeria. Sort of faceless, nameless people who have in many ways more power than the military dictators who put them in power. They run the state security services. And they're very vicious, single-minded, deadly people. And usually almost all of them were colonels, Colonel Akilu and others. They all had the same rank, and it was enough power to get things done, but not too much power to threaten the generals in charge. They were really autonomous, and things that were done in many ways in the names of these military dictators, they weren't even aware of them. They were enacted by these other people.
Chris Abani, when you were released when you were 18 years old, that arrest, you did begin work on a second novel, Sirocco. Now you knew the power of words.
Right. I knew the power of words, but there was already a resistance movement through arts that were going on that in many ways emulated what Ngugi wa Thiong'o and Dedan Kimathi were doing in Kenya. And the idea was to mobilize everyday people, market women, people on the streets, through making them perform anti-government sketches, and that way, if the idea was that the performance of it would lead to a sort of an embodiment and of a change of consciousness. So even when I began to construct the second novel, it was constructed purely within the same crime genre theme without it meaning to do anything like that. In fact, it was actually a plot for the PLO to insert botulinum toxin, which is a biological weapon, in the water supply of Europe, which is kind of scary now, given how many years later with 9/11. But the real thing about the book is it never made it out to the light of day. It was impounded at the publishers, completely destroyed. There are no copies existing anywhere. All we have a sort of a manuscript flying around and bits of covers here and there. That's really all there is. So in many ways, it's become a mythical book that doesn't exist. And part of the metaphor of opening of Graceland, where the invisible man falls off his chest and cracks in two, is sort of how things like not only the symbological level of literature, but the actual text itself can be disappeared and made invisible.
Were you arrested without knowing what was going on? Or?
I was arrested, but I had a sense that it was had to do with the theater. It was assumed then that this plot, you know, was a thinly disguised call to arms for people to overthrow the government, and that it had nothing to do with the PLO, which it was really all it was about. You know, the first time I went in, I said it wasn't too bad. I was protected by a lot of people in prison, and so I had no real concept of it. And when I was arrested the second time, nobody even knew where I was. My family had no idea what had happened to me. And I remember sort of sitting in that place thinking, I'm being held now in a maximum security prison by killers, with killers, and nobody knows I'm here. And it was the most terrifying moment. In many ways for me at that point, that 1 year where I spent in that time became the transformation not just of myself as a writer, but myself as a person. Because you're in prison with people who have no real political ambition. These are people who were living their life, came into confrontation with authority in terms of, say, watching a soldier beat somebody on the street and intervening, did the right thing with no sort of forward thought that, oh, they might get a book published or they might be known as activists. Couple that with torture, which beatings, rapes and things like this, which completely erode the ego. You can't help but come out of it realizing that your initial motives were all wrong, that the idealism was misguided, and that your own ego often obscured what the real issue was. When I came out of that experience, I think that was the one time I really, really understood what the resistance movement was about, what people like Wallace Soyinka had paid for dearly, what countless other people before me who never got any attention had paid for. It humbles you. You change from this sort of naive idealism to a real sense of political understanding, and so that anything you do from that point on is entirely for the right motives and is entirely about the situation and has nothing to do with you for the first time. And it's oddly, really oddly, a liberating and redemptive moment as a person.
During that year, did you have any hope?
Initially, I had no hope, but the wonderful thing about being in a situation like that is that people resist always the erosion of their humanity. And there's a line in one of the poems from the Book of Poems about that experience where I said that I came to realize that the best in us cannot die. It will not die. And people did remarkable things, tender things in prison to protect me because I was very young, to protect other young people. You do begin to acquire hope after a while because, I mean, I cannot explain why I survived when there are thousands of Nigerians who have never survived and lots of who have survived and have never even gone to the point to even talk about what they've been through or been given the platform to talk about what they've been through. And so you do begin to think you've been given a gift that you have no explanation for, and the very least you can do is to live. And hope is not a sort of hallmark card moment of hoping. It's something more real. I don't know, it's like taking a plunge into an ocean but realizing somehow that there is a current that will hold you up, and despite your fear and your thrashing, you'll swallow a lot of salt water but you won't drown. I think it's more like that.
What was the release like?
The release was very frightening, more so than even being in prison, because a lot of times people were released into death, in a sense. The release meant being disappeared for real. A whole bunch of us were let out. It was a change in government, and I remember standing by the gates thinking, what do I do now? If I move forward, they might shoot me in the back. People are looking at me, and I'm thinking, I must stink of death. I must stink of shame. But nothing happens, you know? You look around, there are people frying plantains at the side of the road, selling them. You buy a Coca-Cola, and you realize that the transformation isn't a big mesenaic moment. It's an aggregate of all these subtle, tender, kind things that strangers do for others. And that horror in its ultimately doesn't overwhelm you, because it's very easy to protect yourself from pain. What it isn't easy to protect yourself from is the kindness of strangers. In a way, it overwhelms you, it breaks you down, it makes you completely vulnerable. But that's what ultimately saves you, because then at that moment, you reconnect with what it is to be human. And that's what happened. And I went back. I was in university. I went back very quiet, very cowed, until, you know, an opportunity to write another play, a real play this time, came up, and I thought, you know, people have paid in blood for people like me to exist. Going all the way back to people who resisted slavery, to people who resisted the British, and part of what it is to be human is not to not be afraid, but to do something even though you are afraid. And so I went back to being an activist in a way. That was the last arrest.
And then you came to the United States.
And I went to London first. I was bought out of prison and went to London and lived there for about 7 years. And I actually have only been here about 3.5.
You got out of prison. How long did it take, time-wise, for Chris Abani to return from that person that got out of prison?
About 5 years. I got to London in 92, and I didn't speak about the prison experience until 97. And in many ways, I'm still returning. I spent 6 months in solitary. You're very intense when you come out, and you're bristling, and you know, people look at you, and you look like a demented serial killer in many ways. It's hard to sort of... People say to you, how are you? You don't know what do you say? And so you have to learn to talk about the weather, to have conversations that allow you to interact in a human way, but that don't sort of mark you as different. And so that took a long time to learn. And then you also then have to begin to confront memory. What happened to you? How much of it are you recouping as truth? How much of it is just what you imagine? How much is it so buried and warped that you can only come at it from the side? And if all this is unreliable, then what was the point of everything you went through? What is the point of all this stuff? And how do you begin to articulate a new way forward? And that's sort of also partly where I come into Graceland, is this kid is always descending into these moments of darkness, and it's how far can he go before he can find his way back? With all this stuff going on, knowing sort of all the things that happened to you within your masculinity, how do you find a way to articulate love? Not as a sort of wishy-washy thing, but as in the way Toni Morrison articulates love, as this powerful force that is transformative, not just of you, but those around you. But then what do you do with all the rage? Because there is rage. Do you let it go? Because you need the rage to indignation is what fuels rebellion. So it's finding ways to be effective in your life, and that is useful and effective in other people's lives. And then I finally decided that if I was to articulate this in any way at all, it would have to be with poetry, because it allows, first of all, for a medium where people can step away from it, from the frame. It also makes it easier for you to construct something that is not about ennoblement, that is really just a testament. But this novel actually came to me about, I suppose it's 2 years now, but I wrote the book in 9 months, and the idea came to me when I was looking at some pictures of the Rwandan tragedy, and there was a guy standing there wearing after the tragedy in the reconstruction, wearing a Free When on a Rider t-shirt. And as I began to write a book which is essentially about culture and cultural exploitation, my story began to creep in different ways, which is inevitable, I suppose.
You've been listening to an interview with Chris Abani, whose novel is titled Graceland. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.